Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, good afternoon, American, to another exciting adventure here on Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. And handsome of all co-hosts ever, we have Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Thank you, Annie. Appreciate that wonderful introduction. Welcome, everybody, on this beautiful, beautiful October 23rd. The debates are finally over, and just a quick reminder, as always, we will be posting links into the chat room about all our electronic media. Annie has a very cool website set up, so you can actually buy Southern Sense material. But Facebook and Twitter, we're reaching out to you. Spreaker, Stitcher, come on now. Give a listen to the best radio show on BTR.
Yep, also up on iTunes. And the website is up and it's active. You can go in there and you don't have to look for the show anymore on BTR. Just put into your bookmarks on your computer, southern-sense.com. Click on that, and you can catch our shows. There's a link there to all the shows. There's a link into my personal blog. There's a membership page you can sign up on. And I have a little store on there for if you want T-shirts or hats or tote bags or whatever. Yeah, I mean, even little coats for your doggies. It's all up there. So check it out, southern-sense.com, or just hit southernsense.webs.com. Either way, you get yourself in there. I also put up a link in the chat room for those that are listening in. If you do go on to southernsense.webs.com, click on the blog. I just posted up yesterday. A friend of mine, Eddie Burns, and some of you may know that name, was executed point-blank range by the orders of a jailed drug kingpin. He died February 26, 1988. His killers, four of them, are coming up for parole I'm in South Carolina, up in New York. It doesn't matter if you don't live in New York. read the blog, scroll down to the end. There's a link there that you can actually send a petition to the New York State Parole Board asking them to deny these four murderers any parole whatsoever. All you have to do is put in your name, address, the name of the convict, and what they call a DIN number. That's the inmate number. And just click on it and say, no, deny them parole. These are cop killers. So please read the blog. You can find it at BufordTeaParty.blogspot.com. I mean, that's got my blood boiled on this. We're going to be dedicating October 30th show to him. Eddie Burns and I went to the Academy together.
Oh, really?
Wow. We were friends. We were in sister companies. He went into Queens to the 109. I went to the 90. And we really didn't keep in touch. It was a tremendous loss to all of us. So please check out the petition we have there to deny these four cop killers parole.
Here's a little bit of history. I bet you're going to get floored when I tell you this. Eddie Burns' father, also a police officer, presented Eddie's shield to who?
George H.W. Bush, who carried it in his campaign in 1988. Yes.
And how about that for someone from Michigan to know a little history, huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that was used in the video for the introduction video for George Bush, I think, at the convention. I've seen it along the lines. I like to go to a lot of the presidential libraries and watch tapes of whomever. Doesn't really matter whether I like the president or not. But I remember after Mr. Byrne presented the shield, George Bush talked about how hard it was not to cry. I didn't know that. Wow, that you two went to the Academy together. Now, this was a big-time dealer, too, wasn't it? He wasn't like your average street corner yo slinging, you know, $10 cracks.
No, it was Pappy Mason and Fat Cat, I forget what his last name was. They basically ran all the drug trade in Queens, New York. And Pappy was behind bars, and he wanted to ice a cop. So David McClary took his orders and planned it all out, and in fact, Eddie Burns was their third choice. They cased out the house. It was a guy from
DNI.
It was a witness's house. Arjun was the witness's name, who helped put Pappy behind bars and was willing to testify against other drug dealers. And the first time they cased the house, they decided to call it off because the officer guarding the home was a female. Second time they went over, they called it off because the officer was black. The third time is when they executed Eddie Burns, a white kid, sitting alone in front of this house guarding the witness. And they walked up, executed him point-blank range, and shot him five times. But we'll talk about this on the 30th. Let's get over to our dedication for today.
Okay. All right.
For those who do listen in, every show is dedicated to a fallen hero. And today's dedication is going out to Marine Lance Corporal William Visovich. He was killed by an IED in Iraq on March 30th, 2004.
All right, music's going.
Okay, U.S. Marine from Victorville, Lance Corporal William J. Visovich, 20. Died in Iraq on March 30th, 2004, when his vehicle drove over an explosive device. Visovich was assigned to the Marines in August 2001 and was a combat engineer assigned to the 1st Combat Engineer Battalion, 1st Marine Division, 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in Iraq's Al-Anbar province. He was stationed at Camp Pendleton, according to Department of Defense. Willie Visovich's story is a terrible twist on that of a boy next door. He was a good kid, respectful, yet fun-loving, with a close-knit group of friends, his family said. He married his high school sweetheart, and they had a baby daughter. But Visovich had just 1 month of marriage with his sweetheart, Veronica, whom he married on January 7th before a new military rotation scheme took him back to Iraq. He got one visit with his daughter, born while he served his first tour in Iraq. At 19, his wife, Veronica, is a widow, too stunned to speak publicly about her loss, and the baby, Ariana, has no father. Miss Ovich's mother, Patricia, sympathized with her daughter-in-law's sorrow Wednesday night as a steady stream of visitors came to her house in southwestern Victorville, not far from Fair Valley Road. "I had Willie for 20 years, and she got him for one whole month," Patricia said, tears coming down time to time as she reflected on her son's life. Visovich had not wanted to return to Iraq, and during a phone call that last final month, he had told his sister Sheila how dangerous he believed it was. He had been back in Iraq for little more than a month. He was planning to follow in his father Joseph's footsteps by making the military a career. Joe had served a hitch in the Marines before enlisting in the Air Force. Willie had planned on doing the same. His friends and family stressed how full of life, fun, and positive energy Willie was. "A firecracker," said Teresa Kay, a family friend. "So respectful, yet so full of fun," said Lynn Arrowhiskey, another friend. Visovich had been a football running back who played for Hesperia and Victor Valley High Schools. "It was an honor and a privilege to have coached him," said Leland Udy, Visovich's football coach at Victor Valley and a family friend. "He had a lot of heart and a lot of character. It was always yes, sir, and no, sir, with Willie. My son Brian and he graduated together, so we knew him pretty well. This is a great loss. He had a lot of heart and gave football the same kind of dedication and commitment that he gave to serving his country," he said. But most of the reminiscence of this was his exuberant and affectionate nature. "He couldn't just say hello," said Kay. "He had to give you a big hug." His mother remembered the teen who, with his radio blasting, would jump out onto the driveway to dance his current favorite song. "He would be singing along, and he couldn't sing a lick," she said, laughing and crying at the same time. Willie Visovich's great loves, all three, were Veronica, his wife, and Ariana, his daughter, and his custom Honda Civic. He would call his mother from Iraq to ask her to buy parts for it that he had found on the internet. He also loved pranks and practical jokes. Returning home, he would call on a cell phone and announce that at the last minute, the military had prevented his leave, only to throw open the door and march in. "I guess I just don't understand," his grieving mother said. Why they had to take his life when he enjoyed it so much. In addition to his wife, daughter, and parents, Visovich was survived by three half-sisters, two half-brothers, and was buried with full military honor at Joseph Memorial Park in Victorville. "Sarge dedication, Lance Corporal Willie Visovich. And now we dedicate to him, to all our fallen heroes, and to those who are still serving this great country. This is My Name is America by Todd Allen Herndon, and you can upload this tune on YouTube.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand.
That was Todd Allen Herndon, My Name is America. And as I said before, you can find this up on YouTube and download it from Todd Allen's site for free. So we have an exciting guest coming on here today, don't we, Mike?
Well, we certainly do. Is he on the line, actually?
Yes, he is. So let's bring aboard our guest, Gus Venegas. I hope I'm saying the last name correctly. He's author of a fantastic book called The Land of the Intolerant Tyrant. Good afternoon, Gus.
Hi, Annie. Hi, Mike. How are you guys doing? That was a wonderful song. And, the name of the book is Memories from the Land of the Intolerant Tyrant. And
Hand was over the word memories.
Yeah, I know. If you just Google Intolerant Tyrant, you'll probably get my publisher, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and my Facebook page, etc. It is a book about the Cuban Revolution and life in Cuba. I'm a retired NASA engineer for over 32 years. I worked there. I retired, and I took it upon myself to write this book as I felt it was the most to read for those understanding the Cuban Revolution and understanding perhaps past Godfather Part II or some of the Hollywood stuff, answering many questions that Americans may have had about Cuba. It is an interesting book narrating a story of intrigue, deceit, and betrayal in the search of absolute power by Cuba's totalitarian dictator Fidel Castro, who recently had a stroke, but we understand he's still hanging there. We see the metamorphosis of Castro from a young idealistic pro-democracy liberal in the late 40s to a totalitarian Stalinist dictator after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. The book explains the failure to Castro delivering his promises of political freedom and economic prosperity to the average Cuban. Of course, had I stayed in Cuba, I wouldn't have published such a book because it is not legal to do so, to criticize Papa Castro, and anybody in Cuba with anti-communist literature is sentenced like to 3 years in jail. As a matter of fact, last year they had 2,400 political prisoners in Cuba.
When did you come to the States, Gus?
Okay, let me tell you a little bit more personal about myself. I was born in 52, and, of course, my parents were supportive of the revolution first, and they wanted the Batista was a previous dictator that overthrew the republic in 50 years in 52. So And Batista was kind of a laissez-faire dictator. I was one of the people cheering the rebels when they marched through my hometown back in 1959. But members of the family noticed that Cuba was being radically transformed and that this transformation, political and economic, was going the way of a Stalinist state. In 1965, my parents decided it was time to leave Cuba, utilizing the Freedom Flights. And after some paperwork and, you know, having claims from relatives that had left Cuba earlier, we left in 1966. So I've been here since 1966. I was 13 years old then. It was easy for me as a child, you know, a teeny bopper, adapting to life in the U.S. And, you know, you always have sweet memories of the hometown, family get-togethers, trips horse riding and fishing in one of my uncle's farms, stickball games with playmates. You know, by the time I left Cuba, there were not too many baseballs out there. And, you know, and a couple of vacations to the Baradero Beach Resort, which was very cheap to visit after 1959. I believe we visited in 1959 and 60 with other relatives. We rented a house. It was tougher probably for my middle-aged parents to be exiled from the land of their birth, leaving many family members and friends behind. And but I also have memories of the daily lack of freedom of expression. As a matter of fact, there's a joke that Cubans have very strong necks because they're always watching who's around when they talk, you know, politics, hard times getting consumer goods, imprisonment of distant relatives and a few friends that died trying to regain freedom for Cuba. I'm grateful today that my parents made the decision to leave. You know, I'm comfortably retired now in a home in the suburb of Florida after working 32 years in the aerospace industry. I have a nice set of wheels, plenty of food in my belly, and I'm able to vote and express myself openly in the land of the free. Had I been in Cuba, you know, it would have been a different story. I would have been working for the Castro regime for a meager $20 a month. Probably would have been playing the black market in order to make ends meet. And I probably would have had to keep silent about criticizing the Castro regime. And we had to struggle for getting scarce consumer goods, like I mentioned, on a daily basis. So life in Cuba is tough. So,
wow. I have a couple quick questions.
Yes, sir.
Walk us through, Gus. Obviously, I'm a huge Godfather fan. But exactly, Fidel Castro led a hostile takeover. Was he elected first? How long before eventually Fidel became the monster we know him as? Like, walk us through the very beginning of the changing of the guard.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned the Godfather, because I wanted to have a segment on the Cuban Revolution, and I wanted to have another little segment on Fidel Castro before the revolution, because a lot of people are not too familiar with that. You know, the picture of Cuba is nice beaches and palm trees and cigars and drinks and señoritas and Hollywood romance kind of stuff, but if you're a tourist, that's true. But if you're the average Cuban living there, forget it. You know, it's a different picture. Cuba before the revolution was very well off. Most of the buildings in Cuba were built before 1959. Under Batista, the dictator that when he was falling behind in the polls in the 1952 elections, you know, he decided with his buddies in the army to throw a coup d'etat and overthrow the Republic of 50 years. And the problem of the Cuba under Batista, the predecessor of Fidel, was the lack of political rights that were available with a very liberal constitutional republic that that he overthrew in 1952. Because it even addressed workers' rights, you know, to unionize and all sorts of things that even the U.S. Constitution doesn't have. So the Cuban Constitution before Batista was a little bit to the left. You know, there were very strong independent unions in Cuba before Fidel, and Cuban industrial and agricultural workers were amongst the best paid in the world back in the 50s. We're talking maybe $3 to $6 a day. You know, that's close to, $60 to $120 paid a month back in the 50s, that wasn't bad money. And there were workers from neighboring islands coming to Cuba because of abundance of work. And there were even immigrants from, like, countries in Europe, like Spain and Italy. Cuba had a higher standard of living than a few countries in Europe back at the time, particularly southern Europe. Of course, the problem was political. But Cuba had a very efficient production by the free enterprise system with independent unions that resulted in such a high standard of living. Education-wise, also Cuba, before Fidel, was a Latin American country with the highest budget for education in 1958 with 23% of the total budget, and it was followed by Costa Rica at that time. And, at that time, I believe the countries with a higher standard of living may have been Costa Rica, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Cuba was among them, there was a disparity between various countries in Latin America, but Cuba wasn't definitely one of the poorest ones, and it was not a revolution by the poor. It was really more a middle-class revolution to overthrow Batista for political rights. And I know this because my family supported the revolution. I guess maybe I should go talking about young Fidel Castro.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because everyone thinks Fidel Castro came from the poor, dirt poor people. He was one of the people, and that's why he rose up with his revolution. That was the furthest thing from the truth.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Fidel Castro's father, Angel, he worked successfully in various agricultural businesses, ventures out there in the Mayarí region in eastern Cuba. He stayed encompassing 25,000 acres. I think most cities in the U.S. are not even that big. And it required anywhere from 600 laborers to 1,000. So he made the Hewings in Dallas look like poor people. Angel's first wife left with her two kids after learning of his extramarital affair with a 15-year-old servant named Lina Ruz. Angel was about 30 years older than her. Lina Rook took over the running of the house and was treated as Angel's wife. She gave birth to three sons and four daughters. Fidel Castro was the third of these children. Angel was a very hardworking and recreational businessman that had a Spanish military background that provided Angel with some leadership skills. Angel would be one of Fidel Castro's many role models. Other boyhood heroes of Fidel Castro, and we know this through his sister Juanita in Miami, who's been in exile since the 60s, were Alexander the Great to Napoleon. As a matter of fact, he changed his middle name to Alexander after Alexander the Great. He admired men that reach greatness through a mixture of leadership skills, charismatic personalities, and the use of force and intimidation to secure and expand their power base. In 1942, Fidel went to the prestigious Belen Jesuit School in Havana, probably the best high school in all of the Caribbean, where he distinguished himself, debate, oratory, and competitive sports. He was recognized as having extraordinary intelligence, and while he was there, he admired such fascist leaders of the early 40s as Hitler, Mussolini, Perón, and José Antonio Primo de Rivera, who was Franco's predecessor. I had to look him up. I was going to go on into his university days now in the University of Havana. Fidel went into the University of Havana in 1945, and while in the university, he joined the liberally flavored Orthodox Party, and came in contact with various members of the Cuban Communist Party at that time. That was his first exposure to any communists. He privately told one of them called Alfredo Guevara, who was a filmmaker, no relationship to Che, that he would be a communist if he could be Stalin. So that kind of gives you an early indication that, of his ambition, had people known about this back in the 50s during the rebellion against Batista, Fidel would have still been in the mountains, In December of 1946, Fidel ambushed and shot through a lung Leonel Gomez, who aspired to be leader of a student federation a position that Fidel also wanted. And he hit from the law in Rafael Diaz Balart's home, who was his brother-in-law at the time. Now the Diaz Balart family, they're all in Miami, and some of them are involved in politics. I think a couple of them are in Congress now. The victim, Gomez, survived, naming Fidel as his attacker. Chino Esquivel, a trusted Castro University friend, witnessed the attack and told of it after he left Cuba. It is suspected that Fidel got off the hook because of his family's wealth and connections. Of course, after Batista did his coup d'etat in 1952, when he was lagging in the polls, he overthrew the pre-Osorio-Ras government a few months before the elections with the help of his army cronies. A few days later, Fidel Castro distributes a manifesto entitled Zarpazo.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, because that was written in 1957. But everyone seems to think that the Cuban Revolution was something that happened overnight. It happened over 7 years, right?
That's true. It happened over a period of 7 years. It started with as soon as Batista took power. But, of course, people took a time to react. There was not the widespread poverty which, the Castro regime claims there was. People were well off, but, they got sick and tired throughout those 7 years of the Batista government. So you're right. It was a slow process. Fidel at the time wasn't unknown. He wasn't like, oh, look at this guy. Let's everybody follow him. No, it took him a while to build the support he did. And he really didn't become the undisputable leader of the revolution, actually, till about 6 months before the fall of Batista, when all the revolutionary groups united under him. This may be a good time to talk about the revolution.
Before you mention the revolution, all my life, all my 26 years of life, I was under the impression the revolution took about a week, and I was also under the impression that Fidel Castro was basically an orphan who was broke. Up until right now, I always believed Castro was like, just a kid on the street playing stickball. I was not aware he was from affluence, and I wasn't aware he was educated in the Catholic schools. So, wow, I'm learning more in the last 10 minutes than...
We'll get into what he did to the Catholics a little bit later on.
I didn't mean to interrupt, because I just...
No, that's fine.
All right, Gus, I do have to admit one thing. I love the feel of a book, and unfortunately I couldn't get your book in time, so I had to download the Kindle version. Oh, boy. You know what? That's pure torture. So I'm going to ask you, if you can, one of these days you're going to have to send me an autographed copy of your book, because I've got my notes written down on a scratch pad and on the Kindle. It's kind of hard to go between the two because you're talking so fast and going through so many subjects here. I mean, it is so exciting reading some of this stuff. For example, a lot of people don't realize the Revolutionary Army was made up of three components.
Well, there were several revolutionary groups. As I said earlier, I guess we'll go into the struggle. And, the main two groups, in my opinion, were there was the one that Castro had, which was called the 26th of July movement. And it received that name because Castro had his original attack on a Batista barrack back in July of 1953, on July 26th. So, as a matter of fact, he had 150 men in that attack, and only one of them was known to be a communist, and that was his brother, Raul, who came out of brotherly love. Most of those people that went in the attack were either students in the university that were activists, or they were labor activists, workers, But most of them were associated with the liberally flavored Orthodox Party. And as a matter of fact, the attack was organized in Artemisa in a Mason lodge, a Freemason lodge. So, and I guess there were a few members of that lodge that participated in that attack. The other distinguished member that I mentioned in the book also was... called Jose Antonio Echeverria, who was the leader of Revolutionary Directorate. And he perished during one of the attacks on the Batista Palace. Later on, during the struggle in July of 1957, three of the leaders of the revolution, Fidel Castro, Felipe Pazos, and Raul Chivas, who was a brother of Eduardo Chivas, who founded the Orthodox Party that Fidel belonged to, they signed the Manifesto of the Sierra Maestra, a document that calls for general elections, calls also for freedom of the press and independent labor unions, and the release of all political prisoners, things that unfortunately are not happening in Cuba now. Fidel got elected eventually leader of all the revolutionary groups in 1958 by the Pact of Caracas. Representatives of all these groups went to Caracas during the summer. These groups were the Orthodox Party, the Authentic Party. Those were the two biggest parties in Cuba at the time. The members of the Revolutionary Directorate, which I mentioned earlier, Fidel's 26th of July movement, and there were a few other groups. The Second Front was another group that was a split off of the Revolutionary Directorate. And they came to the conclusion their only way to beat Batista was for all those groups to unite. And after the death of José Antonio Echevarría, who may have been the most popular leader before he died, Fidel became kind of like the choice at the time. He was a very good orator, a very smart man, came from an affluent family, you know, may have been like a Kennedy or a Rockefeller or a Heinz in Cuba. So in 1959, of course, after years of the revolution, Batista is overthrown. And Fidel becomes the prime minister and army chief at the same time. The provisional government starts collecting weapons from all revolutionaries. There was a little slogan called Armas para qué, guns for what? So that's the first thing they did, disarm the population. I figure the Second Amendment people would like to hear this, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I put that in there. In June of 1959, the new provisional president, former judge aligned with the Orthodox Party called Manuel Urrutia, resigns and goes into exile, alleging that Fidel Castro is appointing too many communists to middle government posts. So there were some allegations about this. Urrutia was kind of like not a well-known judge. You know, it would have been like appointing somebody from the Supreme Court to be a provisional president just to preside over the transition government. You know?
Yeah, he wasn't qualified for anything.
Yeah, he was not a well-known political figure. People hardly knew him, and not a lot of people believed him when he said that Fidel was appointing too many communists and he was smelling something funny, you know. And it is unfortunate that not a lot of people believed him, you know, including people in my family. I don't remember that they all turned against Castro at that time during the summer of 59. However, the time when at least people in my family got suspicious were in October of 1959, when the new Camagüey province governor, Uber Matos, who took over the second biggest city in Cuba, Santiago, not far from Guantanamo, was arrested because he made the same allegation that Manuel Urrutia did, that there were too many communists being appointed to middle post positions in the government. He was accused of treason and sentenced to 20 years in prison. The new Revolutionary Army commander, Camilo Cienfuegos, who was at that time number two person and probably nearly as popular as Fidel, mysteriously disappears in an airplane accident a few days after the arrest of Uber Matos. It was known that he was not in agreement with this arrest, and there may have been some discussions, and probably people like Fidel and Che and Raul, who were kind of taking Cuba to the left in the direction of the Soviet bloc. Apparently, there's rumors that part of his disappearance was due to the fact that he disagreed with Fidel. Let me tell you a little bit. I feel, Camilo, his disappearance was October 28th, so I kind of felt a little guilty, and I felt that I had to dedicate a few minutes to him. He was one of the original revolutionaries that came with Fidel from Mexico in the Granma boat in 1956. There were like 82 revolutionaries in that boat. It is alleged that only 12 survived. In 1957, you know, he showed himself to be a very capable commander, and he became one of the top leaders in the Revolutionary Forces, appointed to the rank of comandante, commander, you know, same rank as Fidel. In 1958, Cienfuegos was put in command of one of the columns that headed west out of the mountains from eastern Cuba with the intention of capturing the provincial capital city of Santa Clara. Che Guevara was in charge of another column, and Jaime Vega was in charge of a third column. The third column, unfortunately, did not make it. He was ambushed, and his troops dispersed. But the other two columns made it to central Cuba. They united forces with the Revolutionary Directorate and the Second Front, who were very active there, and they managed to take over the city of Santa Clara eventually. Camilo distinguished himself before the Battle of Santa Clara in the Battle of Yaguajay, where a lot of Batista's troops surrender, and eventually he was the guy that took over Havana. You know, Fidel sent him ahead with his troops to Havana, and he's the one that convinced the you know, Batista still had 15,000 soldiers active in Havana even after he left, and he's the one that convinced the Havana garrison to surrender, and he was for a long time Castro's number two guy.
Now, so, I want to ask you a question here, because you're giving us numbers of troops, and you're saying like 87, and we as Americans, when we think of our troops, we think of them in thousands. Now, meanwhile, Batista had thousands of his own troops. How was it that such a small group of rebels could overthrow such a superior force?
Yeah, Batista's army overall was number 50,000. But many of them, like when the troops of Che and Camilo and Jaime Vega passed nearby my hometown in east central Cuba, the troops remained in the garrisons. You know, they went on a strike, and that was often done, and that's one reason why Fidel won. You know, and the rebels won, because a lot of the troops didn't want to fight for Batista. So
there was rumors that some of the leaders of those troops also accepted bribes just to sit.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, Che Guevara's biggest victory was there was a train coming with reinforcements from Havana, and he cut off the train. Some of the military officers, highest ranking officers, come out. Che goes there with a big bag. I don't know. I guess he had rumors is that they had a few $100,000 and gave it to these guys. These guys, they take off and go to Miami in exile. And the only officer that remained there to negotiate the surrender was the doctor that was there. You know, I think all the other officers were bribed, and he's the one that negotiated the surrender of the troops from that train. So that is documented, and I make a reference to it in the book. But it is, you know, you have troops that are getting bribed, officers are getting bribed, you got troops that don't want to fight, and that's how it happened. You know, when Uber Matos showed up to take over Santiago, which had 10,000 Batista's group, that was the second biggest town in Cuba, he had less than 1,000 rebels with him, and the garrison surrendered to him, you know, and they were a number 10 to 1, but they didn't want to fight for Batista, you know. So
also, the United States had its hand in there, because in 1957, a new ambassador was appointed. His name was Earl Smith. And very shortly after that, the United States placed an arms embargo against Batista.
That's correct. The United States placed an arms embargo against Batista. If you hear all of the Hollywood baloney, you know, they say, oh, Batista was the U.S. puppet or whatever. No, as a matter of fact, Eisenhower feared Batista. Eisenhower assigned as one of the members of his cabinet, Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, who was a leader of the Cuban Communist Party for a long time. Imagine if somebody had in our government had named a communist to the cabinet, you know. There'll probably be a lot of people raising their eyebrows here, you know. Well, Batista did that. So Batista really was not a good stepping right winger, white supremacist. As a matter of fact, Batista was ethnically, his heritage was mixed. He was white, he was black, he was part Chinese, he was part native Cuban, you know, Indian, you know. And I think it's so odd that a lot of people think he was some sort of Nazi or good stepping Nazi or something. And it is odd because Fidel is the one that used to admire Hitler. You know, I don't think it may have been for racist views or anything, but it's just that Fidel admired people with charisma and leadership and that could lead troops in the field, you know, that kind of old romantic warrior kind of thing that I imagine Hitler inspiring his army in the early years of the war, you know, like the old warriors from old Greece and Rome, Alexander and Julius Caesar, et cetera. So, you know, you're right. You know, the U.S. government didn't want Batista in power, and even the ambassador of the United States went to Batista and asked him, maybe you should leave. You know, they did this in private, and I don't know if he was offered exile in the U.S. You know, I know that eventually he wound up in Spain. He went through the Dominican Republic when he left. But, you know, it's not what people think that, you know, Batista was not somebody that the U.S. government supported, you know. And you're right, there was an arms embargo against Batista.
No, but Batista was an elected, he was elected first into office, correct, way back?
Way back in 1940, Batista was elected president. The country was prosperous. As a matter of fact, Cuba joined World War II on the side of the United States, and I think the only countries in Latin America that sent a small amount of troops to World War II were Cuba and Brazil. They each sent like 3,000 soldiers that fought in the European campaign. Cuba, as a matter of fact, knocked out a German submarine. It was with a U.S. Submarine that was bought from the U.S., but they actually knocked off a German submarine. So the Germans had a station, so apparently one sub outside of Havana Harbor and had knocked off one or two cargo ships. And all of a sudden, a Cuban crew goes there, and I guess they must have been near shore or something, and one Cuban sub knocked off a German Nazi sub. So I didn't make a whole lot of reference to World War II or Batista's 1940 presidential run, but he was known for corruption, and that's why he wasn't doing well in the 1952 election. The Cuban Constitution, you cannot run two terms back-to-back. But you could, lead for 4 years or 8 years and come back later and run. And that's what Batista was doing, you know. So,
what are the terms there for a president? 2 years, 4 years, 6 years?
4 years.
Four years.
And you cannot have back-to-back, terms. So, if you want to run for a second term, you got to wait for somebody else to be in the middle. I think they did this ironically because they fear a dictator like Batista or Fidel. This was put in the original Constitution. And, of course, they saw how unstable most of Latin America, unfortunately, was at the time in the early 1900s. I think the most stable country in Latin America at that time was Costa Rica, who's had I think it's the second oldest democracy in the continent after the U.S. There's been a struggle in Latin America because it seems like, we had in Latin America, unfortunately, a lot of linkage between dictators and people with in the military with guns, you know. And unfortunately, Cuba fell prey to this first in 1952 under Batista and then in 1959 to Fidel Castro.
Wow. Now, Fidel Castro's group, the 26th July group, he used that as actually a holiday that became more popular than Christmas, right? It had to do something with Batista and his military barracks?
Well, that was good publicity for him when he attacked the barracks back in 53, you know, even though he lost militarily and he was arrested and he was in prison for about a year and a half and then released by the very liberal Cuban justice system. You know, and sent into exile you know, and of course then he came back in 56 from Mexico with the 82 revolutionaries and eventually won the struggle. But, you know, he was a good politician, a very smart man, very skilled. As a matter of fact, talking about support from the government when he was in the mountains, he had a radio station that was, the hardware for it was provided by the CIA.
Wow.
He got support from the CIA. You know, he got support in the U.S. At that time in Miami, there was a community of about 20,000 Cubans, and they were mostly anti-Batista. A lot of them were affluent members of previous administrations preceding Batista. And they coughed up money. They lobbied for support for Fidel and his guys. You know, Prio Socarrás, the former president of Cuba, he even went to, when Castro needed money for his expedition in 56 to go back to Cuba and buy a boat and get arms and all of that, Prio Socarrás came with his bag of money and gave it to Fidel, who crossed the Rio Grande pretending to be a Mexican worker and came, got the money, and went back. You know, so, you know, I didn't go into all the details of this back, but, you know, I read over 30 books on Cuba. I lost the count after 30 books, and there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, you know, the Cuban Revolution is really full of drama, you know, and there's a lot of misconceptions, particularly in the media and the folks in Hollywood, you know, that make it look like the U.S. was really against Fidel from the outset. No, we the U.S. supported Castro during the revolution, and he received money, and he received manpower. You know, there were people like Camilo who came from the U.S. Camilo was exiled before. He went to the U.S. and came back and joined them in Mexico. And there were, you know, essentially when he went from Mexico, it was something like a little Bay of Pigs kind of thing. You know, he came with his 82 guys. He landed in a swampy area, whatever, you know, but one of Batista's planes spotted him. He lost most of the men that were with him, but eventually he held out in the mountains for a few years, and people would join him, like one of my cousins, Emilio Martinez Venegas, who I tell his story in the book. You know, and he joined them, and eventually he went to prison. As a matter of fact, Emilio Martinez Venegas went there with Manuel Artime, who was one of the leaders of eventually the Bay of Pig expedition, you know, and the Humberto Sori Marin, who was their commander at the same rank as Fidel, became the original Department of Agriculture, head of the Department of Agriculture, and when he saw that Fidel, instead of going by the Sierra Maestra Manifesto and saying, you know, they were talking about breaking up some of the big states and giving the lands to some of the small farmers, but they would have to compensate the owner, you know. And Fidel said, no, we want to take the lands and make it into cooperatives, the style of the old Soviet Union. And they would have members of the Communist Party take over the farms, people that didn't know anything about farming. And it is a pity because that policy has resulted that Cuba, who was a former food exporter, is now importing 80% of its food, mostly from the U.S. and Brazil. You know, we're actually one of, despite of the so-called embargo, you know, we're one of the main providers of food to Cuba, you know, and we've been for a few years now.
Yeah, you mentioned the Soviets, and everyone assumes the Soviets' presence did not start until Fidel took over. But actually, it dates as early as 1925. But somehow the records disappeared? What's the story on that?
Well, the Communist Party was in Cuba from the mid-20s. As a matter of fact, one of the first actions by Fidel's troops, there was somebody that was keeping tabs, a journalist that was keeping tabs on the Communist Party. He had some big files. They were all in paper. This is long before the computer. And one of the first things, the first few days of the revolution, they go to this guy's office. They tie him up. They take all his files. They burn him or take him, and you never saw him again. So I don't know if some people have a theory that, well, Fidel was in with the communists back from the the years when he was in the mountains. Some people speculate that after the triumph of the revolution, he liked power a little bit too much. It was like an addiction, and he thought that maybe the best way to stay in power was to form an alliance with the Soviet bloc, you know. His brother, Raul, was the liaison. Later he used Che, you know, traveling back and forth to the Soviet Union in 59. And eventually in 1960, Anastas Nikoyan, who was the deputy to Nikita Khrushchev at the time, I remember he visited Cuba in 1960. And they started collaborating, and Fidel would take him to some of the new cooperatives and whatever. During the 1960, Cuba started getting a lot of the Cuban army, a lot of weapons, you know, from the Soviet Union, machine guns, rifles, howitzers, tanks, etc. You know, as a matter of fact, part of the reason why the Bay of Pigs invasion or landing was scheduled in April is because there were a lot of MiGs coming in May, with lots of trained pilots where Castro had sent to the Soviet Union. So for those of you who are JFK fans, if you read any JFK biography, you would know by then, during the 1960 presidential debates, JFK accuses the Republicans of dropping the ball in Cuba. And, you know, I provide more comprehensive detail of this, of the revolution of life in Cuba in the book, that, you know, my book Memories from the Land of the Intolerant Tyrant. But, you know, you're right. You know, there's some misconceptions about, you know, about Fidel and Cuba, and that the revolution was a communist upheaval, and it was not. It may have been maybe liberally flavored or reform-minded, you know, progressive maybe you could call it, but it was not intended to establish a Stalinist police state in Cuba, which is what eventually what happened.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons for my misconceptions is based on a little bit of what you learned in school, but basically through movies. The Godfather was instrumental, and you mentioned that as far as basically the movie, midway through the movie, Fidel starts his revolution. By the end, Fidel's king. So right away in your mind, you draw a conclusion. This took place a couple of days. He was king, when obviously you're drawing a much more great detail of all this. This is like, I could listen to this for the next 10 years.
Well, you know, it's true, but I think we got like half hour, so I'll do my best. And I was thinking maybe talk about the rebellion that there was in the countryside a little bit, the Bay of Pigs.
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned the movies, and Michael Moore had that movie he had coming out where he was touting how wonderful the healthcare is in Cuba and how fantastic the stores are. But there's one thing that tourists see, and then there's reality. What is the reality?
Well, I was planning to cover that a little later, but let's cover it now since you brought the question, because I know that's one of the main things about Cuba. So let's talk about living in Cuba today. What you got today in Cuba, I call it the Castro system of political apartheid, where you deprive those not aligned with the government from access to more food, better health care, housing, and access to college education. Only members of the Communist Party, a privileged minority in Cuba at the time, and visiting foreigners get to go to the good stores and hospitals and hotels and houses and receive a college education. I know Cubans visiting there, including some of my second and third cousins who I keep in touch with, they know this, and as they are a tourist since they're visiting. You know, the Cuban exiles now, they're like, you know, big tourists over there now. So they can go to the good stores, but the average person, you know, cannot go there unless they're aligned with the Communist Party. When Michael Moore went to Cuba, he was shown a hospital assigned to foreigners and Communist Party members, not the hospital assigned to the average folk. You got to bring your own bed sheets. You pay your own medicine. You got to kill the roaches. And if you're lucky, you get an aspirin out of them. And, you know, I got a few, you know, if you join, like, my Facebook page, I got clips of hospitals that people nowadays with cell phones, you know, they take pictures of that. I mentioned earlier in the segment that the Castro communist monarchy, they pay an average salary of $20 a month, which is a meager salary. You know, you got to be in the black market over there in Cuba. People grow, you know, potatoes and peanuts in the countryside like if it was a crop of marijuana over here, like it was something illegal, you know. And it's a pity that that's the slave wages in a country that doesn't even allow independent, labor unions, you know. So, of course, they blame the communist embargo, the embargo by the U.S., but like I mentioned earlier, ironically, Cuba is importing food from the U.S., and I have a little segment that I also got in my LinkedIn page there somewhere talking about the embargo, where you hear Hugo Chavez during one of his visits to Cuba, he asked Fidel, hey, Fidel, what is this nice chicken and rice? Where did this come from? Fidel answers, pollo gringo. So it is, I don't know, a little bit humorous, but a little bit sad, too, at the same time. You know.
Yeah, now, they started rationing the food, you know, at the beginning of the revolution, and that was supposed to be temporary. How temporary is it, and how much are people allowed to have to eat?
Well, it is being so temporary that it is still temporary today.
<It's> 53 not funny.
Years later, you know? You know, I imagine, if there was an election in Cuba now, probably Raul would ask, you got to give me 53 more years to fix this, you know? So, I don't know. One reason Cuba, of course, is importing food or whatever. People are not exactly starving, but I think they figure out what is the minimal amount of food that people can eat, keep them just operational so they can do some work, and keep them hustling from day to day so that their main problem is worrying what they're going to put for dinner, what they're going to put on the table the next day, you know. And, you know, you got to make long food lines there that sometimes they exceed a city block, you know. I remember my father getting up real early in the morning, and he would go to some of these things, you know, before the sun came up, and people would bring their own chairs, you know, if Apple is going to have their Nest iPod, you got a bunch of these people out there going with a line around the block. Well, that's a daily occurrence in Cuba, you know. And it's a pity. Of course, if you are in the touristy neighborhood, you don't see that because you get to eat everything you want, et cetera. As a matter of fact, Ilian's father used to work in the touristy resort of Baradero Beach that I went to as a child. He was a bartender, and when his kid came to the U.S., actually, you know, the wife didn't have any relatives here. Ilian stayed with his Miami relatives. All of a sudden, there was some rumor that Fidel, who is reported to practice Santeria, that if he didn't get Ilian back, he was going to fall out of power, you know. So all of a sudden, he starts pressuring the family over there, you know, hey, you ain't going to have a good job, you ain't going to have this or that, you know. You could pressure people in many ways in a totalitarian regime to persuade him, but, you know, that's why they wanted Ilian back, because Castro got obsessed with having Ilian back, because for a few weeks Ilian was in the U.S. and nobody said anything, but all of a sudden, after he was here for a few weeks, Fidel changes his mind. I don't know, you know, he, like they say in Spanish, they had an arrebato, all of a sudden he went into some sort of childish prank, and when you're the dictator, you get what you want. And unfortunately, he got Ilian back there treating him good. But talking again about the embargo, I share the concern that in some day soon we'll see relationships between Cuba and the U.S. normalize and improve. But that will not happen while Fidel is calling the shots, because Obama, Actually, he made a gesture of reconciliation back in 2009 and says, hey, Raul, let's talk about lifting the embargo. So Raul says, hey, you know, let's sit down and talk about it, you know. And then Fidel, within 24 hours of hearing this in the news, you know, he's in his bedroom there listening to the TV and newspaper reports, and Fidel comes out and says, no, you made a mistake. You misunderstood my brother. And what happens is, like some guy in a cigar shop told me many years ago, Fidel likes the status quo of isolating himself from the U.S., who's his big Satan, you know. Like Khomeini in Iran used to use the U.S., you know. He likes to keep the average Cuban starving for consumer goods, anything from food, education, healthcare, housing, computers, cell phones, internet. And despite of the double-tongued, confusing rhetoric, he doesn't want reconciliation of the U.S. You know, that's his big Satan, you know. If they made up with the U.S., that means that the previous 53 years they've been doing the wrong thing, you know. So several of the last 11 presidents, you know, have tried to reconcile with Castro, and they all fail, you know, Obama being the last one. And it is not Obama's fault or Jimmy Carter's fault or Clinton's fault or whoever. It's just that, you know, when you're dealing with a dictator, you know, unless you oust the dictator, things are going to happen the dictator's way. And people need to understand that, that he was not elected president or anything. He's there by the power of the gun, you know. And as a matter of fact, a couple American citizens who probably thought that the U.S. was being very oppressive with the so-called embargo were jailed by the Castro regime, not by the American regime, but the Castro regime. One of them was Major League Baseball scout Juan Ignacio Hernandez Nodar, who was released after 13 years in prison for trying to recruit Cuban ballplayers to play for Major League Baseball.
Jeez.
You know, so that's a crime in Cuba. Those guys get $13 a month, by the way. But I imagine they must have some fringe benefit. Maybe they can go to the good hospital, or maybe they can go to the good store. Maybe they get some free food. I don't know. You know, I don't know what the deal is, because I never... I left when I was 13, so...
You tell a great story, and a lot of the stories in there concern your Uncle Leo, who fought originally on behalf of the revolution. But you have a really gut-wrenching one where you're talking about Leo being jailed and his son, Tony. You want
right.
to tell that? Oh, that just drove me to tears.
Yeah, no, that was emotional. I have to admit that... I cried during that. What happened, my uncle Leo, he fought on the side of Fidel Castro against Batista. He was actually with the Revolutionary Directorate, which was with Jose Antonio Echevarria, was the original leader. But actually, when Fidel marched to our hometown, my uncle Leo was right behind him. You know, he makes a joke, oh, if I knew what the future held, I would have shot him right there. You know, but, you know. And of course, I remember, particularly when I was talking earlier about Camilo and Uber Matos, you know, Camilo disappearing, etc. You know, I remember him and my dad and some people. I was just short of 7 years old, but I remember the big argument. Hey, you know, I think Fidel, look at this, he's arresting Uber Matos, who was another revolutionary, you know. You know, Camilo's disappeared, you know, and they had suspicion, you know, and there's allegations that Fidel has got putting communists in mid-post positions in the government, and they were starting to get suspicious back in the October 59 time frame after Castro was in power 10 months. And a lot of people that were getting that way, you know, suspicious of Castro at that time. Of course, at that time, there was still a free press. Elections have been scheduled, you know, so, and Castro didn't cancel this till mid-1960, when it was obvious that he was a dictator, you know. Shortly after the disappearance of Camilo Cienfuegos and the incarceration of Uber Matos in October of 59, he canceled labor unions, independent labor unions, and other things. So eventually, Uncle Leo was in the a contra, like you would say, you know, against Fidel. And, you know, he was caught having anti-communist propaganda, anti-Castro propaganda, and he was incarcerated. You know, they held him temporarily about a small police station that was about barely 50 yards away from my house. You know, so my cousin, who was must have been barely, Jesus Christ, 8 years old, perhaps, you know. He comes to see me, and I'm there. I'm like a year older than him, and he wants to organize a rescue. So, you know, I see this police station. He's got like 200 people with machine guns around them, you know. So I know he's undergoing all that pain. So I don't know. I guess God gave me the gift of BSing, and I just kept him busy there. Well, maybe we should dig a tunnel or do this or steal a tank. You know, you got 8, 9-year-olds talking about this. You know, our military experience at that time was restrained to G.I. Joes, you know. So, of course, his mother calls on the phone and inquiring about him, and he left, you know. You know, after all, he was like 8-year-old kid, and, you know, I remember, you know, he was sad, and he was dragging his feet on the ground, and I was just looking at him. I just was sitting on the wall there of my house and watching him, and, you know, I was thinking, man, you know, I really felt for him, and, you know, it could have been anybody. It could have been my dad, his dad, the neighbor's dad, you know. And in Cuba, there was a lot of pain. You know, you got to remember when somebody goes to prison, you know, that it is like a family illness because everybody feels the absence of whoever's in prison or if somebody dies or goes into exile, you know, that people miss them. And then in particular, if you got a guy that's the breadwinner, all of a sudden you got to help his family, you know. So as a matter of fact, I got another story about him, ironically, that a commander comes in into his class, and I forget how old he was. Maybe he was in second or third grade, and asked everybody that loves Fidel and Cuba, please stand up. So everybody in the class stands up, except for him. He's sitting. So the captain or whoever he was goes to the teacher, what's wrong with him? And he says, the teacher says, forget about him. His dad is already in jail. So,
yeah,
Cuba, you know,
I did a what?
Yeah, because in Cuba, what they would do if the kid's sitting down, if he stayed down, they yelled your dad because they figure your dad indoctrinated you against being against the government, you know. So in Cuba, they train you to do these things, stand up when they ask you this and that, because, you know, after it happens to the first guy, you know. But it is a very totalitarian regime. You know, I compare it with North Korea, except that in Cuba, you got nicer beaches and subtropical weather, you know, you probably got better rum and cigars, you know, but it is a totalitarian regime, all the Stalinist, Maoist type thing, you know, and people think of Cuba and they think, it must be just like Mexico. I said, no, it's not like Mexico, you know. As a matter of fact, there's Cuban refugees in Mexico. I went to Cancun one time, I met a Mexican over there, he was married to a Cuban lady, you know, that had left Cuba through the Yucatan Peninsula, and she married a Mexican over there. And, you know, there's a lot of pain and suffering, you know, particularly when they put your relatives in prison. So,
when you go there to visit, are you limited to where you can go, or can you just get in the car and go anywhere?
Well, back in the 60s up to the late 70s, you couldn't even go back to Cuba and visit. Then the Castro and Jimmy Carter had a deal where relatives from, could visit starting in the late 70s. As a matter of fact, part of the reason that it is alleged that the Mariel boatlift happened is all these Cubans start seeing that all these exiles were coming. They were well-dressed. They looked good. They were healthy. You know, they weren't being oppressed by the Yankee imperialist capitalist pigs, you know. They all were doing well. They were sending their family money, you know, and medicine and stuff like that, and that's part of the reason when you know, when there was the incident in the Peruvian embassy, all of a sudden within 24 hours there's like over 10,000 Cubans pile up there when Castro pulled the guards off, because in Cuba the main reason to put soldiers around the embassies is not that you're going to have terrorists attacking, it's because if you don't put those soldiers around the embassies, you know, the whole population will pile up in the embassies, you know, like it happened with the Peruvian embassy prior to the Mariel boatlift, you know, and the Mariel boatlift came, Castro saying, okay, we're going to let go some people back around 1980. So, you know, now you can visit, you have to get a Cuban passport. I'm an American citizen, and I have an American passport, but no, I have to pay for a Cuban passport and some fees and they make about $300 that way. I don't go there because I got links to relatives that, you know, were against the revolution after Castro turning to a dictator. And I wrote a book against Castro. So normally people that write books against Castro don't go to Cuba.
That's a good reason
to put you in jail. You know, if somebody in Cuba writes an anti-Castro book, you go to jail, you know. So,
Thus, was it true, because I've only heard this through news, and when many of the refugees came to the United States, many of them were taken out of jails and mental institutions, or was that just made up?
Well, no, that is true. You know, that I read at least a couple books that I refer to, as a matter of fact, in my book, although I didn't cover the Mariel Boatlift in my book. I kind of stopped the coverage in 66, but I do refer to the general conditions in Cuba. But during the Mariel Boatlift back in 1980, about 120,000 Cubans left. And I guess a lot of people call it, well, it was Castro just putting the relief valve. You know, it was really embarrassing to have over 10,000 refugees pile up in this Peruvian embassy. So he figured, well, maybe time just to let a few people out, and that way he won't get embarrassed again, you know. And, you know, there's an estimate that nearly 2,000 of those came out from jails or mental institutions. And crime in Miami went up during the early 80s because of these people. As a matter of fact, that... there was a part in Miami that I was told by one of my friends that lived there that not even the other criminals in Miami would visit because these Marielito guys were tougher than. But most of the refugees, 98-99%, were decent people, decent families. One of them, Mirta Ojito, works for the New York Times, and she wrote you know, a book on her experience living in Cuba called Finding Mañana. You know,
yeah,
there was another one.
Well, Gus, I have to do a little something here. My husband, Yanni, his ex-wife is Cuban. He was there at the boat lift, and he took a fishing boat out of the Keys, one of these shrimp trawlers. And all these years, he's always mentioned the story, how they went down, and people had these little 17-foot boats or whatever that you can barely fit three people in, but going from Florida over to Cuba to try to bring relatives back. And he was telling this one point where they had run into a really bad storm, and there was these three boats around their trawler. They were there 1 minute, and the next minute they were gone, and they never saw those people again. That boat lift was one heck of a hairy ride.
Oh, many people died. One of my friends, I didn't go into it because my book already was going to around 310 pages, and a couple of the editors that I was having discussions with, they said, well, you should finish it with about the time you leave Cuba. And I expanded it, actually, when I first arrived to Miami and then lived in Puerto Rico. And I said, you know, because I wanted to do away with the illusion, too, that we all got out of Cuba and started living in Beverly Hills and big mansions. No, we were in a small one-two-bedroom apartments, and had to start from scratch, and you know, get. I even got a part-time job back when I was 14, and you know, to help out my dad. But those boats, one of my friends was in one of those small boats, and it capsized because they would overload the boats. And the boat where he was at, they put a number of these prisoners and mentally ill people there. And it was a panic, you know, and he told me the story, and I thought about publishing it, but, you know, I cut it out. But the story, you know, he actually was overnight, you know, with his small, you know, just floating in the sea there, you know, with a lifesaver thing around him. And he would hear screams of people getting eaten up by sharks, you know, going, ah, you know, and more than once in the night, you know, of apparently other people in the boat, because they all get scattered in the ocean when, you know, the boat capsizes. And, boy, he says that's the worst night in his life. You know, that man, when he saw the U.S. Coast Guard find him the next morning, he felt like the luckiest guy in the world. But, hear all sorts of horror stories from the Mariel Boatlift, you know.
Yeah, and the hotel that they were sent to, the electricity was turned off, the water was turned off, And they said that they could see where the cameras were in the rooms. So when they got to the hotel, there was no rooms left, and the only place left for them to sleep while my husband and his wife were trying to bring her sister out was in the stairwell. You know, they didn't want us there. They did not want us there to take those people out.
They probably wanted you to take it out, but they want to treat you like, hey, I treat my dog better than you, you know, kind of thing. Because they act, you know, a lot of people think of these people like Robin Hood or whatever. As a matter of fact, I drew Castro, the cover, as a Roman emperor, and somebody said, why didn't you make a Robin Hood? I said, well, I have respect for Robin Hood, you know. And, you know, it is a power thing. You know, they're like gangsters, you know, and they just want to show you that they're in top and that they don't have any regard for you. And I heard stories even that one time one of the guards that was guarding the people tried to get in one of the boats, and he was shot. And right there in the bay, and he was devoured by sharks right there in front of everybody, you know. And they didn't even rescue him, you know, because it's like that, you know. Oh, you're a traitor, or if you're one of the gringos coming here, we don't care. And I know at one time it was like a slave market, because I know that one of the guys that I work with here in the Space Center, he's of Cuban ancestry, and he went to see if he could take out his older brother, and you have to bribe the officers there for several thousand dollars, you know. And, you know, if the guy's a doctor or an accountant or somebody with great skills, you know, it costs you more than, I guess, somebody who's just a janitor in school, you know. No offense to anybody, you know, but it was almost like going to a slave market, because there were things like that transitioning there. So it's just the Mariel boat lift definitely was a wow, you know, an experience that, you know, that I know of a couple of people that have written books on it. Mirta Ojito was one of them. Finding Mañana is one of the good stories, too. There was also another one by Reynaldo Arenas, and they made a movie after it, After Night Falls. You know, he was a gay Cuban dissident, you know. So I do not recommend the book for the prude, because he kind of, he's got some scenes that are very sensual, you know. So I want to give it to one of my 90-year-old aunts. But, you know, if you ignore that part of the book and look at the rest of it, he describes life in Cuba real well. And he originally also supported the revolution, you know. As a matter of fact, Mirta Ojito, too, when she was a kid, she supported the revolution, you know. But she realized as she started growing up, and by the time she was 15, that that was no good. But, you know, she was a kid in the school. She got indoctrinated. She had friends that were communists, but, you know, she was being discriminated. As a matter of fact, she was aware of this, and one of the teachers let her know that she wouldn't go to college because her parents were church-going people. And, you know, they would give preference to people who had Communist Party parents, you know. So, you know, I describe Cuba as close to a medieval monarchy that, you know, you got Castro on the top, he's the king, you got the, you know, the communist nobility in there, and then you got all the worker ants under them. So yeah. It is a pitiful way.
Your book is absolutely fascinating, and I suggest anyone listening into this to go to Amazon.com and purchase the book Memories from the Land of the Intolerant Tyrant by Gus Venegas. Gus, are you going to do a follow-up on this, or...
I don't know yet. Yeah, you had a question, Mike?
I got 300 questions, but just in a quick closing, of based on some of the movies that have showed a little bit of which would you say is, for me, go rent this and this will kind of give you a little better perception of what it was like. Is there one out there?
To be honest with you, just about anything that I've seen out of Hollywood it's no good. The most dominant movies, you mentioned them, you know, like Godfather Part Two. Then, you know, I saw Scarface. I had not seen Before Night Falls, you know. And I have the impression from what I've seen of the previews of the movie that they put too much emphasis on him being gay and not life in Cuba, you know. So I wouldn't know how to critique the movie. The book is great, and I recommend it as long as you don't get offended by some of the homosexual passages, you know. You know, just read quick through that. But, you know, some of his description about life in Cuba, you know, Annie was mentioning earlier, you know, already in the 70s there was a deteriorating structure, you know, lack of water, lack of electricity. It was even getting rationed. You know, you get some neighborhoods, they get electricity for just 12 hours. You know, as a matter of fact, if you get meat in Cuba, you better eat it right away because, you know, you can't preserve it because, you know, if you have a refrigerator, you know, it may not have power all day, you know, and sometimes you may lose power for several days. And it's just a pity. You know, we have really become a third world country, you know. The life in the 1950s looked like a step forward, you know, and it is a prison, a pity, you know, that this has happened. In conclusion, you know, the Cuban economy under the Castro regime the last 50-plus years has been a total failure under the mantle of socialism. Most of the income in the country comes from tourism, cash remissions, and from exiles and oil subsidies from Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. In a country with the most fertile soil in the Caribbean, today Cuba, a former food exporter in the 50s, imports 80% of its food, mostly from before the, I call it the robo-illusion instead of revolution, you know. The all infrastructure, buildings, utilities, transport is deteriorating and needs to be upgrading. Like I mentioned a little earlier, the political repression is only a tad behind North Korea. And the average salary, like I mentioned, $20 a month, which is not even what people used to earn back in the 50s, anywhere from $60 to $120 a month was the average salary. In Cuba today, hey, it is time for change in the direction of political and economic freedom. Do you guys have any last questions? I know we got about 3 minutes left.
Wow, thank you, Gus.
Gus,
this is awesome.
We could have done a three-hour show easily with you, Gus, so I am going to invite you back here again. I want to remind everyone that his book is up in Amazon. It's Memories from the Intolerant Tyrant, if I put my teeth in straight.
Memories from the Land of the Intolerant Tyrant.
Thank you. You got that. All right.
I thought about calling it Betrayed Revolution, but Leon Trotsky beat me to it, the guy that Stalin took out, you know.
Right.
Yes. You know, so I don't know. That may be a subject for another program.
Okay. All right. And I hope everyone joins us back again on Friday. We're going to have Dr. Waleed Ferez. He is Romney's foreign affairs expert for the Middle East. He's got himself at least a dozen books out there. He's going to be a fantastic guest. And then following next week, we're going to have Rick Amato, the conservative radio talk show host from California. Gus, I want to thank you so much, and we will have you back on again.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you, Mike. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you guys. And like you mentioned, we could have been here 3 hours. But, hey, we could maybe a couple months down the road, we can do another show. And,
yep. Gus, I liked your – I put a like on your Facebook, so you can friend request me. I'm Cool Mike. I just liked your page. So thank you very much. Annie, as always, man, you get the great guests. Wow.
Yes, and Dana is in the chat room saying, great show, so is Bob USMC. Want to thank both of them. Thank everyone for participating in the chat room. So, again, we'll see you back here on Friday, same bat time, same bat station. So be safe,
Annie,
and God bless.
Maybe Gus and I will go back to Cuba and revolutionize it. Good night, everybody.
You're a lot younger than me, Mike, now. I'm an old diabetic, high blood pressure. I'll just be a drag on everybody. But when I used to be your age, I used to be Superman.
Oh. There we go.
So,
again. All right.
Yeah, 150 pounds
everybody.
Ago. Thanks a lot.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.
American.